Today is Thursday, December the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today. And coming up in the next half hour, President Biden says he's made clear to Vladimir Putin that Russia would pay a strong price if he decides to invade Ukraine.
Economic consequences like none he's ever seen.
And Germany has a new leader. Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, bringing an end to Angela Merkel's four terms at the helm of Europe's largest economy. The World Health Organization says new data is emerging every day about the potential impact of the new Omicron variant on the coronavirus pandemic, but it is premature to draw conclusions about the severity of the infection.
There is also some evidence that Omicron causes milder disease than Delta. But again, it's still too early to be definitive. Any complacency now will cost lives.
And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered an inquiry and says that he's furious after a leaked video showed senior members of his staff joking about holding a lockdown-breaching Christmas party. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Biden says that he made it clear to Vladimir Putin that Russia would pay a strong price if he decides to invade Ukraine. AP's Washington correspondent Saga Megani has more.
The president says there were no minced words during their two-hour chat yesterday, that he politely told Putin there would be severe consequences for an invasion.
Economic consequences like none he's ever seen.
But asked if he'd send American troops in to stop Russia.
That is not on the table.
Noting the U.S. is obligated to protect NATO allies if they're attacked, but not Ukraine, which is not in the alliance. Putin wants guarantees Ukraine will never be a member, and the president's promising talks with Moscow and allies to address concerns about NATO's expansion. Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
In a virtual summit on Tuesday, President Joe Biden laid out to his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin the steps that the U.S. would take should Moscow decide to invade Ukraine. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara has this report.
On the day Ukraine's armed forces celebrated the 30th anniversary of their formation in 1991, after the country had broken from Russia, Ukraine's fate was discussed by U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin, who met virtually on Tuesday.
Hello. Good to see you again.
The meeting, which U.S. news organizations were not permitted to film, followed their in-person summit in Geneva in June. Biden warned Putin to stop mobilizing troops along the Ukrainian border, almost 100,000, according to some estimates. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
If Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States and our European allies would respond with strong economic measures. We would provide additional defensive materiel to the Ukrainians above and beyond that which we are already providing. And we would fortify our NATO allies on the eastern flank with additional capabilities in response to such an escalation.
Ukraine has been fighting pro-Russia separatists in its eastern region since 2014, when Moscow seized Crimea. At the summit, Putin demanded guarantees from Biden that the Western military alliance NATO would not include Ukraine, which is seeking membership. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov. This is Biden's second virtual summit with an adversary. In his November virtual meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden discussed another territorial hotspot, Taiwan. Max Bergman, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, via Skype.
If Russia is seen as getting away with invading Ukraine and somehow being seen as succeeding here, China will be watching this very closely and will see it as sort of as a dry run for a potential operation against Taiwan.
VOA asked whether the U.S. is prepared to deal with the nightmare scenario of a Russian invasion of Ukraine and a Chinese invasion of Taiwan simultaneously. Again, Jake Sullivan.
The United States is going to take every action that we can take from the point of view of both deterrence and diplomacy to make sure that the Taiwan scenario you just described never happens, and to try to avert the invasion and deter the invasion into Ukraine. That is the object of our policy right now.
The White House said the two leaders had a productive discussion on JCPOA, talks on the Iran nuclear program that are currently on hold. As his administration focuses on pandemic recovery ahead of the 2022 midterm elections, Biden is eager to avoid conflict. Hours before his meeting with Putin, Biden marked the 80th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor with a somber visit to the World War II Memorial in Washington. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Congressional leaders have reached a deal to increase the debt limit. AP's Mike Hempen reports.
The agreement will allow Democrats to increase the nation's borrowing authority without any votes from Republicans. It also likely averts another rush to avoid a federal default. Hours after the agreement was announced, the House passed legislation overwhelmingly along party lines that kicked off a multi-step process. If it's approved by the Senate, it would open a process for the Senate to raise the debt ceiling through subsequent legislation with a Democrats-only majority vote. Republicans have warned they won't vote for any future debt ceiling increase. Mike Hemp in Washington.
A federal judge has blocked the Biden administration from enforcing a COVID-19 vaccine mandate. AP's Mike Garcia has more.
The Biden administration has hit another roadblock in its efforts to implement coronavirus vaccine mandates. U.S. District Judge R. Stan Baker in Augusta, Georgia, has blocked the administration from enforcing a COVID-19 vaccine mandate for employees of federal contractors. Baker issued a stay blocking enforcement of the mandate nationwide. It's the latest in a series of vaccine mandate setbacks for the administration, as Republican-led states and others have been successfully challenging federal vaccine requirements. All three of Biden's broad vaccine mandates affecting the private sector have now been put on hold by courts. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Voice of America.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Olaf Scholz has succeeded Angela Merkel as Germany's leader. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Scholz has become Germany's ninth post-World War II chancellor, opening a new era for the EU's most populous nation and largest economy after Merkel's 16-year tenure. Scholz's government takes office with high hopes of modernising Germany and combating climate change, but faces the immediate challenge of handling the country's toughest phase yet of the coronavirus pandemic. Lawmakers voted with a wide margin to elect Scholz. Merkel, who's no longer a member of parliament, looked on from the spectators gallery as the vote took place. Lawmakers gave her a standing ovation as the session started. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered an inquiry and says that he's furious after a leaked video showed senior members of his staff joking about holding a lockdown-breaching Christmas party. AP's Charles de Ledesma joins us again with this story.
According to the media, the party took place on December 18, when restrictions in London prohibited most indoor gatherings, and a day before, Johnson tightened restrictions, ruling out family Christmas celebrations. The joke-telling video has poured fuel on allegations officials flouted coronavirus rules they imposed on everyone else. Now Johnson has told lawmakers in Parliament he was furious when he viewed that clip, and he can understand and share the anger up and down the country at his staff members seeming to make light of lockdown rules. Charles de Ledesma, London.
This week marks the anniversary of the start of the First Intifada, a 1987 uprising in which Palestinians for the first time worked in unison, albeit in vain, against Israel's occupation of lands captured in the 1967 Six-Day War. The wave of violence starting in 1987 lasted 6 years and marked a turning point in the larger Israeli-Palestine conflict. Linda Grasstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
After 34 years, the incident that sparked the First Intifada is still a subject of debate. Israel says it was a traffic accident in which a military jeep accidentally hit a car carrying Palestinian workers in the Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, killing four of them. Palestinians alleged the soldiers intentionally hit the civilian vehicle. The next day, after the funerals, Clashes broke out between Israeli soldiers and families of the victims, says Palestinian journalist Safwat Al-Kahlout. He says that afterward, victims' families attacked the police station and students gathered, surrounding a truck belonging to Israeli security forces, and started throwing stones. The soldiers fled to a nearby house and opened fire, killing one Palestinian. Palestinians began organizing a coordinated resistance to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They began mass demonstrations all over the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which, along with East Jerusalem, were the areas Palestinians claimed for a future Palestinian state. Muayyad Abdul Sama is a former activist and prisoner. He says that Palestinian awareness grew as they formed volunteer, student, and cultural committees, which all shared the same national dream to end the occupation peacefully. The world media provided extensive coverage of the violence, but Mary King, a specialist in conflict resolution at the Costa Rica-based University for Peace, says there was something going on that had never been seen before. The first intifada, she says, marked the first time that modern Palestinian society worked together to achieve a goal.
The news media gave tremendous coverage, but they largely missed the point. What was actually taking place was that the entire Palestinian society was unifying to work to lift Israeli military occupation.
The demonstrations often turned violent as Palestinian youth threw stones at Israeli soldiers who responded with tear gas, stun grenades, and sometimes live fire. Over 6 years, starting in 1987, more than 1,000 Palestinians and 160 Israelis were killed in confrontations. The first intifada ended after Israel and the Palestinians began secret negotiations in Oslo to reach a peace agreement. In 1993, they announced the Oslo Peace Accords, a roadmap that was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state within 5 years. There was widespread optimism in both Israeli and Palestinian society, but that optimism proved short-lived. In 2000, a second, much more violent intifada broke out that for many on both sides spelled the end of hope for lasting peace between the two peoples. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The World Health Organization says new data is emerging every day about the potential impact of the new Omicron variant on the coronavirus pandemic, but that it is premature to draw conclusions about the severity of the infection. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since Omicron was detected 2 weeks ago in South Africa, it has spread rapidly to 57 countries. The World Health Organization says certain features of the new coronavirus variant, including its global speed and large number of mutations, suggest it could have a major impact on the evolution of the pandemic. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says Omicron appears to be extremely contagious, with cases in South Africa rising more quickly than the Delta variant. That, he says, indicates an increased risk of reinfection with Omicron, but adds more data is needed to draw firmer conclusions.
There is also some evidence that Omicron causes milder disease than Delta, but again, it's still too early to be definitive. Any complacency now will cost lives. Many of those who don't die could be left battling long COVID or post-COVID condition.
Tedros says governments and individuals must act now and use all the tools available. He says all governments should reassess and revise their national plans based on their current situation and capacity.
Accelerate vaccine coverage in the most at-risk populations in all countries. Intensify efforts to drive transmission down and keep it down with a tailored mix of public health measures. Scale up surveillance, testing, and sequencing, and share samples with the international community.
WHO Chief Tedros urges nations to avoid what he calls the kind of ineffective and discriminatory travel bans that were slapped on southern African countries days after they reported the presence of the new variant. New evidence, however, reveals that Omicron was present in Western Europe before the first cases in southern Africa were officially identified. The WHO warns governments are likely to withhold important scientific information if they believe they will be punished instead of applauded for being transparent. That, it adds, would be very bad for global health. The message may be getting through. Tedros notes that France and Switzerland have lifted their travel bans on southern Africa. He welcomes that and urges other countries to follow their lead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International Edition continues. Lebanon's dire economic crisis is threatening to cancel Christmas for many people. The Lebanese currency has lost more than 93% of its value against the dollar over the past 2 years, and soaring inflation is making it difficult for ordinary people to buy food and medicine, let alone Christmas trees and gifts. For VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
With Christmas trees now costing between $80 to $120, almost double a Lebanese worker's monthly salary, some are resorting to telling their children that Santa Claus is sick this year and won't be able to bring them presents simply because parents are unable to buy the gifts. Most are struggling just to purchase food and medicine. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, reports that 77% of Lebanese families say they lack sufficient food, and 60% of them only buy food by running up unpaid bills or borrowing money. Political analyst Daniel Khalil Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA that although you may see some people shopping and think things are well, that's not the situation for most Lebanese.
People who live from paycheck to paycheck, they're suffering big time. These people will not see Santa, will not see Christmas, will not see anything. You'll get shocked when you go to restaurant. People in the restaurant, they represent how much of the Lebanese society. They're not 1 or 2%. The majority are very poor.
But in the upscale northern seaside resort of Batroun, it's hard to see Lebanon's financial woes. It has just opened the first Christmas market, which organizer Francois Barakat says he hopes will rival those in Europe in years to come. It has drawn Lebanese with money to spend, he told Dubai's The National newspaper. Daniel Khalil Khatib says those Lebanese who have money now receive help with hard currency from family abroad or are those who work with international agencies. Others may have been lucky enough to withdraw U.S. currency from the bank before the government froze dollar accounts. Christmas will also witness a number of Lebanese expats return home to celebrate with family.
At Christmas, you will see celebration because a lot of people coming from outside, but that doesn't mean that people are better off. This is always the thing with the issue with Lebanon because you have a lot of expats coming in and coming out. If we didn't have this inflow from outside of hard currency to Lebanon, people will be dog eat dog. It would have been much worse.
The UN's World Food Program estimates that poverty in Lebanon has almost doubled this past March, affecting 3 million people compared with 1.7 million in 2020. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And let's go to Australia, where refugee supporters have protested outside the British Consulate General in Melbourne Wednesday against a proposed UK law that resembles Australia's controversial offshore detention policy. The protest, called by the Refugee Action Collective, takes place as British lawmakers debate the National and Borders Bill. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
The British government hopes the overhaul of asylum legislation will deter migrants from crossing the English Channel from France. The proposed law contains powers to allow claims to be processed outside the United Kingdom. This could lead to applications being assessed in offshore centres. Australia adopted a similar policy almost a decade ago. Asylum seekers arriving by boat have been sent to camps on the tiny Pacific Republic of Nauru or on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, with no prospect of resettlement in Australia. The government in Canberra has insisted tough border measures that have stopped migrants, often from Indonesia, trying to reach its shores by sea, have saved lives. But the campaigners, who've gathered in a small protest outside a British diplomatic mission in Melbourne, have argued that offshore detention has inflicted grievous physical and psychological harm on migrants. David Glantz is a spokesperson for the Refugee Action Collective, a community campaign group.
The offshore processing model will lead to deaths, it will lead to psychological damage, and it will destroy the lives of innocent people fleeing from persecution and seeking safe haven. Offshore detention has been a cruel and racist disaster in Australia, and Britain should not follow the Australian path. It should turn back at this point and treat refugees as people who need help and not punishment.
Australia has ended its offshore detention agreements with Papua New Guinea, but a deal continues with Nauru, where about 100 asylum seekers and refugees remain. Conditions at both centres have been criticised by rights groups. Australia grants visas to about 13,700 refugees each year under various humanitarian programmes. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And in other news, the State Department says that the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, will travel to the United Arab Emirates, Turkey and Egypt to discuss international support for diplomatic efforts to end the conflict in Ethiopia. The Biden administration has repeatedly called on parties to the conflict in the Horn of Africa country to end hostilities. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Tanzanians this week are marking the 60th anniversary of independence from Britain. The country has been more stable than its East African neighbors and never experienced a coup. But after decades of rule by the dominant party of the revolution, some activists are demanding a new constitution to better reflect Tanzania's multi-party political system. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
80-year-old Paul Erata recalls Tanzania's independence in 1961 and says his life today is better than back then, though not for everyone. He says when we got independence, things were not good because our president struggled a lot when fighting for independence. There was not that much development, but as time went on, at least there was progress, but very minimal. There were still no good roads and few schools. Currently, Lerata adds, things have changed, but still Tanzanians are struggling with their lives. One thing that hasn't changed is the ruling party. Since 1961, Chama cha Mapinduzi, or the Party for Revolution, has dominated Tanzania's political landscape. Its leaders believe the ruling party is the only one capable of developing the country. Samia Suluhu Hassan is Tanzania's president.
Miaka 60 ya uhuru ndani ya Tanzania bara, mambo makubwa sana amefanyika.
She says during the 60 years of independence within mainland Tanzania, many big things have been done. All the leaders have done many big things depending on the economic, political, and financial situation at that time. So, Hassan adds, fortunately, all the transformations were made by the government ruled by the Chama cha Mapinduzi party. Analysts say the current constitution enables the ruling party to continue its overwhelming dominance. The president appoints election officers, the chief judge, and other top decision makers. Critics say those officers are almost certain to side with the ruling party in any disputes. Peter Mandeleka is a political analyst.
Kusalia madarakani kwa chama cha siasa, hasa chama cha mapinduzi katika mazingira haya.
Mandeleka says to remain in power for a political party, particularly the ruling CCM, is one thing, but to continue remaining in power is another thing because Tanzania's constitution says Tanzania will be a free, democratic country that follows a multi-party system. Unfortunately, he says, when Tanzania shifted into multi-party system, the constitution that was formed and a single-party system remained. So there are some weaknesses. Those weaknesses, Madeleka asks, in my opinion, favor the ruling party to continue in power. Rights activists and the opposition Chadema party have called for an update to the constitution, which was passed in 1977. But some Tanzanians like Thomas Meshuko say they don't care how long the party remains in power, as long as Tanzania remains peaceful.
Kwanza najivunia kuwa Mtanzania tu kwanza, kwa sababu Tanzania ni nchi yenye amani sana.
I'm proud to be Tanzanian, Meshuko says, because Tanzania is a country at peace. We thank God. Since before and after independence, despite being many things that have happened in the world, including wars. While Tanzanians have a lot to be happy about after 60 years of independence, the founding fathers' dream of a country where inclusion underpins its political sphere has not been realized, according to some. When and if it happens, 80-year-old Paul Erata says he hopes to be around for all the changes. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Police in Malawi have arrested two former cabinet members and a former Reserve Bank governor over the sale of a state-owned bank. The government says the arrests are aimed at cleaning up corruption, but the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, says the arrests are a form of political persecution. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Former Finance Minister Joseph Mwanamvika was arrested Tuesday evening, while former local government minister Benny Piri and former Reserve Bank governor Dalito Kabambe turned themselves over to police Wednesday. Police says the three are facing charges of abuse of office and fraud. James Kadadzela is the spokesperson for Malawi's police service.
Honorable Mwanamvika and Dr. Kabambe have been arrested on issues to do with IMF's extended credit facility. Honorable Mwanamvika on his own also has been arrested on issues to do with the sale of Malawi Savings Bank in 2015. Honorable Ben Piri has been arrested in relation to some corruption issues at the Ministry of Gender between 2018 and 2020.
The arrest comes 2 days after Malawi's Attorney General told reporters that the government is investigating the sale of Malawi Savings Bank and also issues that led the IMF to withhold its extended credit facility, or ECF. 6 years ago, the administration of President Peter Mutharika sold the state-owned savings bank to Tom Pinganchira, who is now serving a 9-year jail term for attempting to bribe judges who were handling the 2019 election dispute case. Police spokesman Kadadzera says investigations reveal that Mwanamvika and Kabambe falsified some documents in an attempt to convince the International Monetary Fund that Malawi was meeting terms needed to use the ECF. He says as a result of this scheme, the IMF suspended the extended credit facility, which has had a negative impact on ordinary Malawians. The arrests are the latest in a string of cases that President Lazarus Chakwera's government says are aimed at cleaning up corruption. In a statement Wednesday, the opposition DPP, the party of the former President Mutharika, expressed shock at the arrests. Spokesperson Shadrick Namalomba said although they cannot rule out political persecution, the party is anxiously waiting to hear the charges that have been leveled against its members. Malawi University political scientist Mustafa Hussein had this reaction to the arrests.
However, since politics is concerned, you cannot rule out politics as well, because each regime has its goals, what it wants to achieve. But in a way, for an onlooker, it demonstrates probably a commitment to fighting corruption.
Hussein added the government should produce evidence against the former officials and pursue the matter legally to clear itself from allegations of practicing political persecution. Police spokesperson Kadadzera says more arrests will follow soon. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.